from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're focusing on the announcement yesterday that Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster will be President Trump's new national security advisor. And McMaster will assume the post, which was vacated by General Michael Flynn, who was forced to resign for misleading Vice President Mike Pence about talks he held with Russia's ambassador. McMaster is known for his counterterrorism expertise and criticism of President Bush's execution of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we're talking about how McMaster may shape foreign and national security policy under the Trump administration. Michael Nock with us, UC Berkeley Professor of Public Policy and former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Global Strategic Affairs, and Kevin Barron with us from the nation's capital, Executive Director of Defense One, an Atlantic Media publication which focuses on global security and defense. He's also a national security analyst for both NBC News and MSNBC, and we do welcome your involvement in the program. If you have questions or comments or simply issues you'd like to raise, please feel free to join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And let me bring a caller on here. Benjamin, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes. My question is, with the new appointment of General McManus, being such an intellectual and an experienced military person, what is the expected efficiency and effectiveness that we see him being able to kind of rein in President Trump and influence policy in terms of how the president chooses to operate in such a public manner on things like Twitter and to make statements which sometimes seem to be unfounded? What's he going to be able to do, and what are going to be some of the biggest challenges he has to overcome in order to influence policy to actually create a more secure America that is also open in terms of how we operate with other organizations and countries internally and externally?
All right, good question. By the way, that's McMaster, not McManus. But let me go to you, Kevin Barron, and we don't expect you to read any tea leaves here, but Benjamin asked about challenges with President Trump, and there are many.
Well, I think General McMaster, for all of his talents, will have zero success in limiting the president's tweets. But I do think what he brings, or what he's expected to bring, again, is a sense of a cohesive strategy for the war in ISIS, and a way to be a better liaison between the White House and, in particularly, Central Command down in Tampa and Special Ops Command and the Joint Special Ops Command, JSOC, who the guys who are running and fighting the war. The thought that I think the interaction between Tampa and the White House through the Pentagon has been closely watched in the last couple of years, and there was hope that it would maybe loosen up a little bit. The White House under Obama was known for, you know, signing off on too many, if you're a critic, too many operational details. So if there's any potential for making that more fluid, because it's another general who knows the wars, knows the guys he's working with, is going to help, I think, make that as simple as possible. When it comes to big strategy, I'll just say, you know, if you read McMaster's writings, he's a guy who gets it when it comes to allies, when it comes to burden sharing, when it comes to the limits of American force, and he's got total buy-in, as I said, into the idea of training local forces to do the fighting for the United States and coalition partners as much as possible, what's called by, with, and through. That's, the bread and butter of special forces and what they do. So I think that's what he's going to bring. I think, you know, if Trump walks into the Situation Room today and says, I want to defeat ISIS as quickly as possible, I think he's going to hear a lot of what we've already heard. Other than perhaps the only other major outlying events would be like a no-fly zone of some kind. And there's a lot of folks that think that the ship has sailed for that.
Well, speaking of no-fly zones and speaking about Trump policies and going against them, perhaps, I mentioned a talk he gave before the CSIS, the Center for International Strategic Studies. And in that talk, he talked about talked very critically about Russia and the hole that they created, helped create in Syria, and all of the carnage there, to use a word that's being used more about Chicago these days by the Trump administration and Bannon. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on this, Kevin Barron, particularly in light of the fact that President Trump has been, shall we say, at least reluctant to criticize Russia in any way.
Yeah, you know, what Trump does about Russia, a lot of folks right now, when they hear that, they're talking about, you know, the election hacking campaign. But in our world, in defense and with the military, it means what's going to happen in Syria. any end game is going to have to involve Russia at the table. And right now, Russia's in control with when it comes to what Assad is going to do. So if there's any type of a peaceful ceasefire that leads towards a peace, it has to bring them all on board. And the idea of a no-fly zone or a safe haven on the ground or no bombing zone, whatever euphemism you want to use, all of those things would be direct confrontations between the United States and its partners and Syria and its partners. And it just brings the United States and Russia closer to war. And you'd have to force Syrian forces out of territory, keep them out of territory, and basically what are acts of war. So there's a lot of folks that think all the campaign promises in the world aren't going to make a difference. That's not what's going to happen next. The focus really is the Americans can focus on the Syrians on the ground that have nothing to do with Russian-held territory. The Russians can stay with Assad on their side. And eventually, something's going to have to give, and talks are going to have to proceed.
Important question. Let me go to you on this, Michael Nock, from Joseph, who asks, can you please clarify the statutory requirements versus presidential prerogatives regarding the composition and role of the National Security Council?
I believe the president has the authority to have a composition as he sees fit. So the buck stops with the president, he will decide.
It's his ballgame, huh?
His ballgame.
Yeah.
I do think, just circling back to some of the other issues, you know, McMaster served in combat in the Middle East, and he's got close contacts with General Mattis from the actions in the Middle East and CENTCOM. He's got contacts and was touted by Senator Cotton because of the military actions in the Middle East. So if there's any one area that he knows very well and all the complexities, it is in the Middle East, and it is with countering terrorist forces and also what the Russians are doing in Syria. That's a whole hornet's nest of complications, but that's actually his substantive strength at the moment. What's much less clear is what he's going to do or say or lead or process information about the broader Russia threat, which extends far beyond the Middle East, deals with Ukraine, deals with the Baltics, pressure on NATO, pressure on the European Union, about the Chinese military buildup in the South China Sea, about the North Korean threat, about the Iranian threat. All these are more removed from his direct areas of expertise. So that's a problem, and who he's going to rely on, how he's going to manage that process, and what input he'll take from the different agencies is less clear. Then in addition to that, is we should talk at some point about this. You have other concrete power centers in the White House, at least as of now. One is Kushner, who runs something called Strategic Initiatives, which gives him a license to play in lots of different games. And you have the Bannon-Miller team, which was behind the immigration ban and on a number of other issues, and certainly is close on the Russia policy. So even if Bannon is not any longer on the National Security Council, he's clearly extremely close to the president. And how does the general manage these two, at least two other centers of national security input to the president right in the same building as he's working?
Yeah, let me go to that second purview that you just mentioned, Michael Nocton. Let me go to you on this, Kevin Barron, because there are new Trump deportation rules that are allowing, apparently, from the reports I'm reading, for even more expulsions. The Department of Homeland Security announced just today, well, actually released a set of documents that President Trump's executive orders on immigration and border security are now bringing a major shift in the way the agency enforces the nation's immigration laws. This can include more people convicted of fraud in any official matter before a government agency. In other words, people who have, quote, abused any program related to receipt of public benefits. That's that severe vetting that we've been hearing the president talk about. Do we know where Lieutenant General McMaster's is on this?
I certainly don't. And that's an excellent point that, you know, there's a lot that the NSC does that's not just military operations abroad. And so that's where I think McMaster really becomes, like the COO, the organizational manager of the White House team, helping facilitate, policy direction to the federal agencies rather than some grand poobah strategist at the right hand of the president for every single issue. He may become that. I mean, he certainly has that reputation. But again, the president, you know, and you mentioned Steve, he's already got Steve Bannon. He could have gone to any number of giants of Republican conservative national security thought in this town. The problem is most of them, if not a lot of them, became never Trumpers in the campaign. And so they're automatically disqualified by this, by either on their own right or by this White House. That's kind of why we ended up with McMaster in the first place. This was not the first choice. He wasn't even honestly the second choice. You know, and when it came to the campaign, and GOP thinkers for national security, it's a real short list who agree to hitch their wagons to this president.
Yeah, where is Robert Gates? Where is Brent Snowcroft? I mean, a lot of people are saying White House is not necessarily going to those traditional GOP sources.
Well, those two guys are both retired, but Gates, you know, went to Trump. He went to Trump Tower back during the transition.
Yeah.
And it surprised some people, but you know, it didn't surprise me. I know Gates pretty well. I covered him for several years at the Pentagon. And when he came out, both he and Scowcroft's his mentor, by the way, said, if you are asked to serve, please do. I think Scowcroft said, quote, this man needs help. And it's really been crickets. And it's, again, partly because they're not being asked. The White House doesn't want them. There's a bit of a loyalty test. So you get McMaster. Again, you get a guy who's got that reputation, who was on his way up, who will be a straight thinker. And I think a lot of people think if Trump doesn't agree with him or if he doesn't agree with the way the White House is going, he's the kind of guy who will, as generals are supposed to do, walk with his feet. And he would, you know, relinquish that command, if that's how he sees it, to somebody who is really on Trump's policy team.
And again, we do welcome your involvement. You can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Let me go to your calls, and we go to Ryan next. Ryan, you're on.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to ask the question that I think is foremost on a lot of people's minds, which is, you know, given the disgraceful departure of Michael Flynn with respect to his relationship with Russia, what this bodes about the administration's relationship with Russia going forward.
Let's hear you reflect on that, Michael Nacht, if you would.
Yeah, that's at the moment really the big sort of political and potentially national security question. And I think it's impossible to know with any confidence because the president is controlling that policy, and it's been, as you've said, totally non-critical of Russia on all fronts so far. That's not been the public statements of the Vice President, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and others, but it has been the President's public position. So until we get clarity on this, we don't really know what it's going to be. It appears, just on substance, that President Trump thinks a reorientation of policy with Russia, a reorientation of the relationship, can bring great benefits to the U.S. on the issue of fighting terrorism, maybe drugs and some other issues, while being silent about Russia's aggression in Ukraine, in Syria itself, and so forth. So, you know, I would assume that General McMaster's lines up pretty closely with General Mattis and others who were very leery of Russia and count very strongly the nature of their threat, which is as much a political and a subversive threat as it is a military threat.
Kevin Barron, you want to weigh in here?
Excuse me, Michael.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you came to the close there. Go ahead, Michael.
Whether McMaster can make his views known in a meaningful way that can change policy is completely unknown, and I think for sure he'll have Bannon and others in the White House who will strongly oppose that view. Sorry.
Go ahead, Kevin Barron.
I think I maybe would just add, you know, that McMaster wrote a paper on what kind of tank war to prepare for with Russia. Part of his background was focusing on the lessons of the Iraq invasion and the Gulf Wars, of how far behind American, you know, tank capability had become, you know, reliance on light vehicles. And so when looking at the Ukraine conflict and Russia,
he got a silver star for leading one tank against a whole fleet, apparently, of Iraqi
That's
tanks.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. So he just had – in his job down there, training and doctrine command and futures, he had the Army look into what's needed for a potential tank battle. He's a realist for sure. And the same time last year is when the Obama administration reversed the idea that the U.S. could pull out of Russia, Europe with some sort of post, Iraq and Afghanistan war reset, and instead has been sending back those kinds of heavier brigades and training forces into Eastern Europe. So if you want to read read into what the real policy of this administration is toward Russia, I think even it was either Pence or Mattis in Europe this week said, don't listen to the rhetoric, but look at the numbers of troops on the ground and follow the money. If Trump and this White House decides to pull back any of those movements toward Eastern Europe, that's a sign. So far, they haven't.
Well, I'm getting a lot of questions about how McMaster's appointment may affect U.S.-China relationship and whether President Trump will perhaps bring us to war with China, as some are forecasting. In fact, some are forecasting. Steve Bannon has, in a talk he gave, talked about the possibility of confrontation with China. I don't know what we're to make, really, of the fact that there was an apparent shift at first on the One China policy, and now we're back to the One China policy. Again, it's hard to read here. Michael Knox, some thoughts from you?
Yeah, so, this, again, would be an area where McMaster would really have to study up fast. I don't think he knows the players on China policy in the government, in the Congress. I'm sure generally he knows what the key issues are, but it's not been an area that he has focused on. Even to convene effectively an interagency meeting of the NSC on this subject, he'll have a lot of homework to do. I personally think that prospects of a war with China in the short term are overblown. I know Bannon has stated, I think publicly, that war with China and both China and Iran are inevitable. I don't know if this is what he foresees or this is what he wants.
Inevitable clash was his language, as I recall.
Inevitable clash, yeah. So, but I think he's a sober, experienced, level-headed mind that's an important player in a key position. I am concerned, though. The president's national security advisor is not primarily there to go over tank strategy on the battlefield. He did that when he had the appropriate job. He won't have that job now. He may have input to it, but the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the chief staff of the Army and the key Army players should be the dominant sources of expertise on that. He's got to coordinate across the agencies and take as much political and diplomatic and economic and signaling issues into account as military. And none of those areas are areas where he has had much experience. He's written about it, but he hasn't had much experience. Now we're going to see how effective he is. I do think, President Trump seems to be very influenced by interpersonal relations. So we'll see. Maybe General McMaster can just bond with the president. Forget about what the official rules are. If he can bond with the president and gain his confidence, he can influence the president, and the president could adopt some of his suggestions. But that remains to be seen.
Again, Michael Knock, former Assistant Secretary of Defense. And let me get another caller on. Tom, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi, good morning. While I'm not a Trump supporter, I was heartened by Trump's position on the folly of the Iraq war. And besides McMaster's military expertise, does he have any knowledge on the Muslim world? Because I find his choice to be refreshing from the malignant anti-Muslim stance that rivals Putin in General Flynn. So is there any appreciation of Obama's Cairo speech about, Russia and American imperialism in the Muslim world that Obama never really acted on? Is there anything besides action hero, a military figure that McMaster can bring? And does anyone know about his book on the dereliction of duty? Is it more Reagan-esque or more Kerry-esque on Vietnam?
Well, we've been talking a bit about that, and I would say, Kevin Barron, it's probably more Kerry-esque, if that's a fair dichotomy. But the reality of how he separates himself from Michael Flynn is very important here. Michael Flynn was charged with all kinds of Islamophobia. You haven't heard any of that about McMaster.
Oh, quite the opposite. So McMaster has a whole lot of public record available of speeches and quotes where he says things like, the Islamic State is not Islamic. He said something to the effect of, anyone who disparages Islam automatically becomes an enemy of the Iraqi people. He knows far better than that. He spent so much time in both Iraq and Afghanistan. You're absolutely right. In that sense, he's the last guy you would think of to support things like total Muslim ban and have that sort of clash of civilizations mentality.
But here's an interesting question. I'm sorry, just looking at our website, Steve says, I've noticed all the coverage I've seen on McMaster, whether print or televised, refers to him as respected, brilliant, intellectual, and having a reputation for integrity and other flattery of that sort. These headlines occurred within hours, if not minutes, of the announcement. How was it possible for reporters to reach those conclusions so quickly? And I guess, Kevin, from your
We've known him for years.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
I mean, honestly, we've known him for years. Again, he became famous for writing, contrarian things long ago. He's kind of, one of the first people you call if you're having a panel discussion in Washington and you want someone to speak frankly about how the war is going or what needs to be done in the future or what the politicians in Washington are missing out on. He's the guy who comes and has the permission of the Army to come talk, and he's not afraid to do it. It's hard. I think outside of the combatant commanders, the four stars themselves, obviously even perhaps more than some of them, reporters, especially Pentagon reporters like myself, we just know him very well. We're familiar with him.
Number of questions about McMaster's coming in here. I'm just looking at a couple of them. One listener says, as an active member of the military, didn't McMaster have to accept his commander-in-chief's appointment? And Stefan says, or asks, McMaster is known as an independent thinker. How will he deal with his staff being picked by Bannon? That was reportedly the reason the other choices declined the position. Want to opine here, Kevin Barron?
Well, both good questions. I'm not clear on this yet, and I've asked. I mean, it's not an order. It's that you're being assigned. It's not a billet to be filled in the military. So this really is his own choice. And again, if you know McMaster, I don't think he's going to do anything he doesn't want to do. I don't think, he's not required to give up his commission. Yeah, that's the history with Colin Powell. But he is a military man who is still in uniform and serves at the pleasure of the president. So that's the difference between that and having a policy advisor who might get into heated policy debates with the president if that's the person the president wants. Again, maybe that's for this president, perhaps that's Steve Bannon, in which case, by all accounts, this is if McMaster didn't come in to insist on his own team, then he didn't have that problem. Really, a lot of this goes to because Petraeus said this just a few days earlier when Petraeus' name was in the mix. He was over at the Munich conference and was asked publicly and said, yes, whoever takes that job should be able to craft their own team. And I think people took that to mean that's why Petraeus fell out of the running. I'm not so sure. Also, Petraeus, again, is a four-star commander. He was also the absolute top commander for the war of Afghanistan, and he was CIA director. There is a legion of Petraeus followers who would have come in and served with him. McMaster doesn't have that. He's a three-star guy. He hasn't even been a three-star for that long, frankly, and he runs an obscure command far outside of Washington. He just doesn't have an entourage of people that I think the White House would need to worry about.
However, there also were people who felt, Petraeus should be locked up. I mean, all that talk about Hillary Clinton and her email server,
well, yes.
They were making the analogies to Petraeus and, the availability of things that were done with his inamorata and all.
Yeah, he's a felon, and so
his own security
clearance would be an issue. So
here's Elizabeth. Elizabeth, thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, my question relates to how McMaster might handle the reconcile with this travel ban, because as you have already mentioned, he's somebody who clearly respects the people of these countries that he's served in, and understands, along with a lot of other people who have commented on it, that a ban like this is actually going to cause greater risk to our national security than to give us more security. So how do you think he may handle that, since it's basically been spearheaded by Bannon and Miller, as you said earlier?
Can you speculate here, Michael Nock, for us?
Well, I think he comes in having inherited the president's decision, and therefore, and General Kelly in Homeland Security clearly has laid out a plan to implement that policy directive. So as far as I would understand, General McMaster will salute and say yes, sir, and perhaps monitor it in the interagency context of NSC meetings, but basically support it. Now, maybe over time, if he feels it's gone too far or it's made mistakes or it's costing the alienation of important groups, he might perhaps recommend to the president, perhaps quietly, that it should be revisited. But I think in the short term, you know, he'll be there to oversee the implementation of that policy.
And let me thank the caller and get another caller on here. Judith, that's you. You're on forum. Good morning.
Thanks, Michael. It's Judith Paul from Stanford. Hi, Michael. I wanted to make two comments. One, I think I've engaged with McMaster's at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he really is impressive. He's a good choice. But the larger point that the media is missing is that it was perfectly appropriate for General Flynn to talk to the Russians about lifting sanctions. I know Ambassador Kislyak. He worked with us when Medvedev came to Stanford when he was president. And he's a wily old diplomat. And if I were, you know, in the government, I would say, look, we'd love to see the Congress lift these sanctions, but you've got to get the hell out of eastern Ukraine, and we have to mediate Crimea. You see, sovereign territory. So it wasn't that it was inappropriate to talk to the Russians about about sanctions. It's just that Flynn lied about it.
All right, Judith, you're on record. Thank you. It'll stand as an editorial comment. I want to read another comment from Mark,
right,
who writes.
Well, could I just
quickly
comment on that? That it's technically and legally not correct what she said, because there is the Logan Act. Admittedly, it was from the 18th century. But the Logan Act prohibits private citizens from engaging in actions that undermine existing U.S. government policy. And if Flynn, as a private citizen, spoke to Kislyak, basically telling him not to worry about the sanctions, that it would be revisited under the Trump administration, sort of giving him a kind of reassurance that Obama's sanctions would not last, that's direct interference in existing U.S. policy by a private citizen. It's a violation of the Logan Act. Now, people may go on TV and say, who cares? We don't care about it. But it is a law. It's never been implemented, and no one's ever been punished for violating it. That's true. But it's a law that's been violated by Flynn's remarks to Kislyak, if they are true as reported.
Yeah, the Logan Law Act is still on the books, as you said, Michael Nacht. And
right.
Michael Nacht, my thanks to you, and my thanks to Kevin Barron. We've got another hour of forum up ahead. Stay tuned. We're going to talk to George P. Schultz in the hour ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.